International Media Group, 2011, 1065, Mr. Quattro.
Morning, may it please the court, Seth Ostrow, from Ostrow Capital in New York, appearing on behalf of the appellant, International Media Group. This is a patent case with a lot of detail in it, but it really, most of the issues boil down to very straightforward claim construction issues. And in our view, when construed correctly, the claims clearly distinguish overall the prior art record. The two primary terms that appear to be in dispute are phrase three-dimensional image and image element. And in our view, the phrase three-dimensional image should have its ordinary meaning. There is ample evidence in the record of what that is, starting with the dictionary definition type 2, at least encyclopedia definition from the Encarta Encyclopedia, and two expert declarations, Professor Spiner and Dr. Chow, and all of that is consistent 100% with how the patent is using that terminology and what it means. A three-dimensional image is...
This argument only applies to some of the claims, right? We have to reach the image element issue under all circumstances, right? Because, for example, claim 2 wouldn't be invalidated by anticipation of Falcon and Foca.
Just to be clear, if I understand the question, the phrase three-dimensional image does appear in all the claims.
Well, yeah, but claim 2, for example, talks about limits of the left-right images. So even if the patent office were correct about the meaning of a three-dimensional image, that doesn't solve the problem with claim 2. We've still got to get the image element issue, right?
I agree that, yes, that the court does need to address what an image element is. We'll get to it in a moment. I just want to clarify something about claim 2. This some misinterpretation by the PTO from the beginning, carrying all the way through to the director's brief about what claim 2 says. What claim 2 says is that the method results in the generation of a left and right pair of processed image frames. Not just a left and right pair of image frames, but that they're both processed. And perhaps the best way to understand all of these issues, and including the claim 2 issue, is to look at figure 1 of the patent. I brought extra copies in case the court sees me.
So why doesn't image element include pixel by pixel process? In Cooperman itself, they use exactly the same term, image element. And you yourself argue that they use that to describe pixel by pixel process. And so why in this patent shouldn't we view image element as broadly incorporating not only distinct images, as you argue, but also
The term image element has no ordinary meaning. It is not a term of art.
It was used in the prior art to refer to a pixel by pixel process, right?
Right. So that yes, it was used in that. The phrase was used for that purpose. But the way the law works is that a term that has no ordinary meaning is not a term of art, which was established by our experts and declarations. Is interpreted in view of the specification. So it is quite possible that when we use the term image element in our patent, we have a certain meaning.
Well, we've also said you can look at prior art patents to determine the meaning.
Right, but it does not have a single meaning. There's no single term of art, there's no ordinary meaning for that phrase. When used in our patent, there's a 100%.
We certainly agree that it could be broad enough to incorporate pixel by pixel processing.
Not as used in our patent.
No, it's just in the abstract, right? Certainly, standing alone, that term could include pixel by pixel processing.
Honestly, I don't know. As far as the evidence, the reason I say that is that the evidence in the record indicates it's not a term of art. So I don't know what it means standing alone. It needs context. So
when it's used in Cooperman to refer to pixel by pixel, right?
In the context of Cooperman, if I'm reading Cooperman, given that he's basically taking the density, the illumination intensity of a pixel and a
it's on your debt value, and that he said that to the gentleman, I guess I understand what he means, because I'm reading the context of that patent. In the context of our patent, that is clearly not what it means. What is the term is being used is to describe a coherent object that's visibly meaningful to
me. Well, in the volume, yeah, but in the earlier description of the invention, it talks about computer processing of these images. Why couldn't that include pixel by pixel processing?
It's not just the preferred embodiment, with respect. It's the entire specification, and the describing and referencing the term image element consistently is describing something that is visibly meaningful to a user. If we start with figure one, for example, there's a square and a circle. These are image elements that are visibly meaningful to a user. The other examples, the only other examples, are like the nose on someone's face. It might pop out in a stereoscopic, in a 3D movie. Or a cartoon character that you want to have pop out in Toy Story 3 or something like that. Then in columns 3 and 4, there's a description of these image elements as having properties. They have, for example, an outline that a human being, human operator, would identify.
The description of the preferred type, where in the other part of the specification does it indicate that image processing is used?
You said image processing, I assume image element?
Image element.
Okay. This is the only, these are all the embodiments that are being described here.
So it's a question of whether we limit it to the self-embodiments that are described.
No, I would not couch the legal issue that way. The legal issue is that it has no ordinary meaning. So this court has ruled repeatedly, the Honeywell case and other cases, that in that type of scenario, when there's no ordinary meaning, the specification is the best context in which to understand what something means. And in the entire specification, from the beginning to the end, the context of what an image element is only a coherent object that a human being would recognize and be meaningful to a human being. There is nothing in the specification that indicates otherwise. It's consistently assumed that that's what it is. As I indicated, it has characteristics and properties, like it has an outline that a human being would identify. That's in column 4, lines 23 to 27, and later on, column 4 talks about the boundaries of that element.
But the problem is, in that respect, you're talking about someone implementing this process using styles. And to be sure, if someone were implementing it using the styles, it might be quite difficult. But if you're talking about a computer, which seems to be covered by the invention and the description, then you can do it on a pixel by pixel basis, right?
Computers operate on digital binary data, so at some level, yes, but that's not how the term is being used. The way the term is used, even in a situation where a human being would not use a stylus, it's talking about predefined objects like you would have in a video game or in a cartoon where someone has already predefined an object. It's still a coherent object that would be visibly meaningful to a user. There is no description of any specification that the claims require specifying this image element and separating it and processing it as an image element. There's nothing in this description that would indicate that a single pixel could ever meet that, or that it would ever produce a three-dimensional image in any way. So,
in order to look at figure one, what was your point?
It was just to try to provide context to the two primary terms at issue in the case. So, should I take that question as an invitation? If you look at figure one, it provides context as to really, and there's only two figures. The other one is just a system diagram of computers. So this is what this invention is about. It is about taking a real-world image, identified as the rule of 10, where objects appear at stereoscopic depth. So if the court is looking at me making this argument, you know, podium is in front of me, I'm behind the podium, counsel's table behind me, so forth, right? So there's, you see the depth because your eyes are seeing two, you have two eyes, and you're seeing two different images with your eyes. That's the concept of the stereoscopic depth. That's what's shown by 10. That's the real world. Ultimately, what you're trying to get to is that the user see that, again, all the way on the bottom at 80. And what happens is that when someone takes a photograph, if the court had a camera and took a still or a video of me right now, it would look like what's in 20. It would all the stereoscopic depth would go away. It would be a flat, two-dimensional image. So the question is, how do you get that back? So according to our invention, you identify the image elements. So again, these are image elements that you would want to recreate the stereoscopic depth. Things have to pop out. The podium should pop out in front of me, and I should pop out in front of the tables, and so forth. There'd be nothing accomplished by having one pixel of this podium pop out. It's a meaningless image. It would be arbitrary to pick a portion of the podium and the floor and the background just because it happens to be in the two-dimensional image. That's not an element of the image. That's just an arbitrary selection. No, we're not be within the scope of claims.
But if you process multiple pixels, so that you can use the 3D image, why isn't that in the scope of
claims? If it's done by first specifying an image element, then it would be. So the claim requires, claim one, requires specifying at least two individual image elements. So these image elements have to be specified. Ultimately, then the computer is going to do processing later on in the claim step E, this processing of that. Now, within the computer, it takes that representation of a coherent object and it's represented as pixels. The computer.
The written description makes no effort to actually define what you mean by image element.
We're not professing that we were on a lexicographer, if that's what you suggested. We're not taking that position. We're just taking the position that it is not a term that has an ordinary meaning, and therefore you have to go to the specification. The specification does, I wouldn't call it a definition, probably your Honor meant it, but it consistently describes it as having certain properties, that it has a size. It's in column 5, lines 30 to 35, it talks about the image element having a certain size. It has parts, it has an outline, it has a boundary, it has all these characteristics and properties which pixels don't have. And if you were talking about a pixel, there'd be no need to specify. All the computer's images already have pre-specified, the pixels are already pre-specified. So there'd be no meaning to that step in the claim of specifying a pixel element or an image element if it's just a pixel. So our position is that the specification consistently uses the term image element to indicate that it is something that has all these characteristics of a coherent object, and that ultimately, by adding depth information to it, you create this three-dimensional image where things are popping out.
Mr. Osborne, you want to say some more about it?
I did, yes, so I'll go ahead. Thank you.
Let's see if you can now.
Please, Court. Most of the argument you heard here from the appellant was all about term and image element. I'd just like to point out that the dispute over the term and image element really only relates to the Cooperman-based projections. All the other projections, image element is not an issue. Furthermore, let's just say we agree.
But we sort of let it down there. So
I understand, Your
Honor. Move on to the other.
Okay.
In order to sustain the projection of all of these claims, we either have to
right, or you also have the rejections of Falk and Oka based on
information. But Falk and Oka don't apply to all the claims, right?
Applies to a very large percentage of them, but not all. You're correct, Your Honor, not all. You're right, Hirome would be an alternative basis to reject the claims. Falk and Oka apply to many of the other claims. In fact, the independent claim number one, which the big fight, and even claim two, Falk and Oka apply to those. But not in claim two, because claim two, as you pointed out, has left and right recited, where claim one doesn't talk about left and right. But just to get back to image element for a second, even if they were correct that image element would not encompass pixel by pixel approach, the board and the examiner made specific findings that nevertheless Cooperman still discloses groups of pixels where a whole component, like the edge of a house, for example, was being transformed from 2D to 3D. So even if you took their construction of image element, which the board and the agency don't believe is the correct construction, nevertheless, even if we were wrong, we still think that that projection is sustainable based on the factual findings, correct?
Help me, Mr. DeMoss, help me understand, and I'm a little slow on some of this, exactly what is it that the board, in dealing with the claim construction issue, the question of three, what is three-dimensional?
Right.
I'm not quite clear on what their, first of all, what they believe their standard is and how it works. It's obviously not the broadest possible, which is what you presumably use when you're first doing an evaluation, but in this case it would inspire that. So they said, no, we don't use that, we're going to use something presumably narrower.
Correct, Your Honor.
But I'm not clear on what presumably narrower means, because you may remember, you might not have any reason to remember, but I wrote in a concurring opinion not too long ago pointing out that claims ought not to be allowed to be any broader than the invention described in the patent. Others have said similar things. And it wasn't clear to me whether the board's standard for claim construction allowed something broader than what was invented, because that sort of was somewhere closer to what they otherwise would use, or
I'll try to explain it. We tried to point this out in a brief. What happens here is in a unique situation where a patent has expired during the agency.
It can't be amended.
And because of that, the agency, not because of any court, this court or any other court telling us to, but the agency voluntarily on its own came out with a policy that said, look, in that case, when you can't amend, we're not going to track the typical broad usable construction standard. What we're going to do is we're going to try to construe the claim a little more closely the way a district court does. We're going to try to follow court construction rather than broad usable construction. However, when you do that, when you fall into that category of what they would call court construction or following the Phillips, I guess, standards of construction, you still have to apply the ordinary tools of claim construction. For example, looking at the express language of claims, looking at how the claims relate to each other, looking at the specification, how it is read in context of the spec, looking to see whether or not the applicant or the appellant here acted as their own lexicographer. And they did all of that. The board went through
it
those
steps. The same approach.
That's what they tried to do. And they
filed. May or may not be right.
Yet it's a more lenient standard than what is applied under the broad usable construction standard. So basically, lenient in a sense that they're basically giving a little bit more in the construction side of the house towards the applicant rather than the typical broad usable construction. But keep in mind, even
is
then,
it narrower than the broad usable?
Well, not in every instance. Only when there's really an ambiguity would there potentially be a narrow construction. Let's, for example, in Phillips it says, we go through the normal tools of claim construction, and after we've done all of that, only if there's an ambiguity will we lean towards preserving the validity of the claim. That's what it says in Phillips. But if you go through the ordinary steps of claim construction and you understand the construction, you don't get to that point. So that's a limited, what Phillips calls that a limited maxim. So that here, the board did those exact things. They said, hey, let's look at the claim. We see in claim one this term three-dimensional image. And we've asked the appellant.
How did the board end up defining three-dimensional?
And the way they defined it was, yes, it's broader than what they've argued, but it's not unlimited. They said three-dimensional can mean the typical three-dimensional, as the appellant has argued, a left and a right image, stereoscopic, two images that you view together that helps you have the illusion of depth. Or alternatively, as the specification explains, there can be other techniques to impart an illusion of 3D. Other techniques like shading, skewing, blurring, and a computer graphics can perform this. So the board said, hey, your own spec contemplates more than just left and right stereoscopic images to determine what three-dimensional means or three-dimensional means. Therefore, we're construing your claim term consistent with your specification. And since you haven't pointed out any lexicography disclaiming or disavowing any other scope, we're going to go with that construction. That's what the board did. Now, appellant has
your argument is that where the board ended up on a claim construction was within the parameters of the claimed invention as described in the written description.
Which means it would be consistent with the decision of your own that we were talking about earlier. It would be consistent with that. We, the board did not go beyond what the written description defines these claim terms to mean. Three-dimensional was an ordinary term. There was no specialized definition, and the specification talked about the examples where you could impart illusions of three dimension into a typical 2D picture or frame, and you could do that in other ways besides stereoscopic paired images. Now, we don't dispute that, yes, left and right imagery, you know, having two images, that's a very common way of doing it. The spec talks about that common way, but the spec goes further and talks about these other techniques as well. Furthermore, the appellant mentioned the Encarta reference, and he said, hey, Encarta defines what three-dimensional is, and if you look in the record we cited for the Encarta reference, it talks about it, absolutely. We have left and right images. It's very common in the past, over, you know, since the 1940s and the 1950s, the idea of having two images that you could look at separately to give you the illusion of depth, that's common. But they also talk about other techniques to create three-dimensional illusions. For example, computer techniques where they include shading, skewing, blurring, etc. These other ways. Right?
But their argument seems to be that they invented something that has this basic pop-up character to these other technologies and methods that you described.
All that,
that characteristic.
I think all that pop-out really gets to is you fooled the viewer into seeing what they think is 3D. Remember, there is no such thing as an actual three-dimensional item here. Everything's in two dimensions. We look at it and we're fooled into thinking it has depth, right? Where it looks like depth. So as far as popping out of the page goes,
that's also true of the room.
That's
right. That body.
Right. But my point is that popping out of a page is the way a viewer would perceive the image. And yes, if you perceive a picture that was in a computer where they use other enhancement techniques to make it to get it depth, and it fools you into seeing that, you would think that popped out of the page as well. For example, their own spec says there's other techniques. One of the other techniques, they talk about a laser blast, I think. We cite it in our brief. And the laser blast can fool you into the illusion of thinking something is coming forward in viewer space. That's an example where there's not left and right images, yet you've been fooled into thinking that. So all I think the board did was they construed the term three-dimensional to include things beyond left and right images. And to further support that,
but they construed it in a sort of negative way, didn't they? They never really said, here's what three-dimensional images means in this.
Yeah, let's see what the board actually kind of addressed that, because as Appellant pointed out, there was a dissenting APJ in this board decision, and the dissenting APJ made a similar criticism, but the majority of APJs responded to that. I think it's page A81 of the board decision, or A81 of the appendix, I don't know if you have that in front of you, and I think they do talk about their construction, or the way they define the term three-dimensional. And if you go down where it says response to the dissenting opinion, you see that? Further down in there, it's the definition carefully circumscribed based on claim construction precedent and the arguments and evidence of record is not so broad. So broad is what the dissenting opinion would say. It limits three-dimensional images to those produced by known two-dimensional to three-dimensional frame conversion techniques. The majority holding reveals that such known techniques, including computer-implemented stereoscopic techniques and mathematical-type transformation techniques involving curved or textual surfaces, each of which produces a depth effect, which skilled artisans describe as three-dimensional. Now, what were they talking about there? Precisely what
you said, the introductory phrase to that, the implied definition.
Right. So your point is they don't come right out and say,
tell us what they understand when they construe the claim means. They imply that means something.
What the examiner and the board did here was they say, looked at the prior art, they looked at the claim, they construed the claim, and they said, does the claim capture the prior art? They said, yes, it does. Appellant came back and said, no, it doesn't, and they addressed those arguments. And I think you're correct, Your Honor. They will go around the complete perimeter of the claim and construe every single piece of real estate defined by that claim. What they did do is they construed the claim in the context of the prior art, and they construed the claim in the context of the arguments made by the appellant. Now, I think there's a recent case in Ray Jung that talks about that.
That has anything to do with Cooperman, right? Because Berks have
Absolutely.
I'm confused by the dissent, which seems to say, oh, well, because I disagree with the definition of 3D image, I overturn the objections. But it doesn't, well, the dissent doesn't really address Cooperman as prior art.
And I don't think he's overturned. I don't think the dissent meant that he was overturning the Harome and Cooperman objections. He was only overturning the rejections related to Falkenoga, which means all those other rejections are still on the table, even if you agree with the dissenting APJ. And of course, I'm here to defend the majority board decision. I believe that if you read that specification and you read that plain three-dimensional image in the context of their own spec, that their construction was correct and that it's affirmable. But even if you were to agree that that construction was wrong, all that does, it gets rid of the Falkenoga rejections, but you still have all the other rejections based on Cooperman, Harome, and then there's a numerous obvious rejections as well with some other secondary reference. So that really doesn't get them there by winning that yet. We do stand behind the construction of three-dimensional image. I tried to answer your question. I hope that is helpful to you.
The name of the case you might be interested in is retractable.
Excuse me, Your
retractable.
Correct.
Case you could use.
I am interested in that. But I appreciate it. And finally, I'd just like to point out that, appellant has put in their brief that we've somehow confused their argument that they made about the term three-dimensional. It doesn't just mean left and right. Because in our brief, we put down claim two, as Judge Dyke pointed out, says left and right. And that's like a further limiting of independent claim one. So one of our comments was, under the doctrine of claim differentiation, that claim two talks about left and right, claim one necessarily means something broader than that, which we believe encompasses the construction of the board here and encompasses the prior art of the site. So I think that's our primary argument of the case, and I have nothing further unless you have more questions for me, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
I'll start on in more than 2 minutes to about.
Let me begin by addressing what PTO has admitted as their primary argument. It's just dead wrong. With due respect, they're just not reading it right. So if we look at claim two talks about left and right process. The word process is left out in their brief when they quote this claim. If we go back to figure one, just for the purposes of explanation, you see that what's done to frame 20 is to create two process frames, 40 to 30. In each one of the image elements has been moved. Okay? So in figure 30, I'm sorry, reference number 30, the square is moved, one of them, the circle is moved, and one of the square is tough to look at it and see it at the same time. Then there's two choices at that point. See, there's a dotted line going from 20 to 50. You could take the original frame, 20, and combine it with either one of those. If you did, what you would have is that one of the two shapes would pop out, not both, one. As far as claim one is concerned, that would be claim one. But claim two is saying that you take both process frames and you combine them. That is something called binocular 3D, which is that you're really getting, like multiple things popping out. So claim two is talking about taking both process ones. You don't have to do that to get stereoscopic vision. You can take the original frame and one process one. And PTO has been making that argument. It's just trying to explain it. Don't seem to be able to get through. I want to also quickly address, if I may, the PTO has said that the word image element only affects Cooperman. That's not correct. Harome also does not show specifying image element. Harome is talking about, to the extent we understand it, scenes, taking a whole swath of the screen and moving it, and then coloring it differently so that it looks 3D. It would be as if, again, took the photograph of this whole scene, including the podium and all these things behind it, nothing would pop out, just like the image would look, it wouldn't look like what we call 3D.
Why isn't that fit within your definition of image element?
There's no coherent object being specified. The claim requires specifying a coherent object.
So the scene is not a coherent object, right?
No, no. We all, when we go to the movies and see 3D movies, we expect things to pop out of the screen. We don't expect whole portions of the screen to just pop out. That's not what we consider that we pay the extra $4 for. And I see my time has expired, so unless there are any further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Scott.